Well, thank you very much, those of you who are remaining over here. And thanks very much to the organizers of the symposium for inviting me. The title is very dry. I apologize for that. But we'll try and jazz things up a bit. But basically, this is a project which I came upon more or less by accident. And I just want to share with you some of the details and some of the ramifications of what this project might mean. So what is the background here? Anoxia means lack of oxygen. Obviously, insects, like all multicellular animals, pretty much require oxygen to do anything interesting. And the interesting thing about Drosophila, like many other insects, is they can withstand periods of complete lack of oxygen for long durations, greater than an hour. This has been known for quite some time. Gabby Haddad at UC Irvine has done some really interesting work in that area, and a number of other people have too. One interesting thing, though, struck me, and that is that what happens to the metabolic kinetics of the animal during recovery from anoxia has never been looked at. In other words, you can make flies anoxic, you can then resupply them with oxygen, and they will recover, but what actually happens to their metabolic processes during that time? That's what I wanted to look at here. And in particular, if you know, of course, about insect biology and physiology, you know that the spiracles are extremely important because they are the gateways between the tracheal system and the outside world. If they remain open, the insect will rapidly dry out and die. But how can they remain open while the insect is completely starved of oxygen? Because spiracles require closer muscles to actually close. So under conditions of anoxia, insects should rapidly desiccate and die. So I was curious about this and wanted to look at it. So anyway, Drosophila has become a model system for looking at anoxia tolerance. But one of the curious things about Drosophila, as with most insects, in fact, in any insect so far, has been that you can take away their oxygen, you can give them the oxygen back, and there is no evidence of oxygen reperfusion damage. Now, if you don't know what that is, just stick around a little bit longer. We're going to come back to that point. So the aims of the study, very simple. Describe the metabolic kinetics of anoxia and recovery. We're going to look at the effects of altering metabolic flux rates, in other words, just metabolic rates, on the anoxia recovery. In other words, when you increase or decrease the fly's metabolic rate, what effect does that have on recovery? And we're also going to give a try at inducing reperfusion damage. Why would we bother to do that? Well, the reason, of course, is that reperfusion damage is one of the most significant health issues regarding humans. For example, strokes are a model in human biology of reperfusion damage. Organ transplants that end up failing frequently, it's caused by reperfusion damage. Coronary thrombosis and what have you, most of the damage done there is by reperfusion damage. So let's go quickly through the system design. I automated the exposure to anoxia in these experiments. This was done in collaboration with Pablo Schirmann of UCI, and I'll be acknowledging him later. Baselining and all of the other things were automated. I used four fairly advanced respiratory systems, taking ruthless advantage of my position as president of Sable Systems. I could get hold of these things, and did water vapor analysis as well. And as you'll see, the water vapor analysis is really key to this whole thing, and allowed some interesting advances to take place. So just very briefly, here's nitrogen. I could exchange CO2-free nitrogen, CO2-free and oxygen-free nitrogen, with room air, which is CO2-free, water vapor-free, but with 21% oxygen. Could change these over under computer control at a controlled flow rate, and then push them through a respirometry chamber held at a very precise temperature with optical activity detection, so I could tell when the fly was moving or not. And then the gas signal went through a water vapor analyzer and then CO2 analyzer. And then this section over here, which you see circled in red, was multiplied by 4 so that I could get these runs done in a reasonable amount of time. 25 degrees C, single temperature, you can see the anoxia durations there, going up from 7.5 minutes to 3 hours. The anoxia was verified with a very accurate oxygen analyzer. I used 8 flies per treatment, all of which were male. Differences between this kind of study and previous studies, absolutely no mixing of the nitrogen with air. Basically, previous studies would take nitrogen and then flow the nitrogen into a box containing Drosophila, and slowly, as the minutes passed, the oxygen concentration would go from normoxic to slightly hypoxic to hypoxic to very hypoxic to anoxic many minutes later, whereas this gave you total transition from air to nitrogen in a few seconds. So it'd be like comparing a lawnmower to a Lamborghini as far as the speed of the transition is concerned. Activity is measured electro-optically so that there's no issue of subjective determination of when the flies become active or not. It's completely objective. Dry air was used rather than just ordinary air, but of course nitrogen by definition is dry as well, so flies kept in nitrogen are going to be completely dry as well. But we needed to do this because water loss rate had to be measured, and that's best done in really dry air. So let's look quickly at the CO2 response to anoxia. These are baselines over here. The red trace over here is the CO2 output of a single Drosophila in real time. You have minutes along here. Total recording is just under 2 hours long. So here we have a baseline for zero CO2, fly, baseline, fly. Here, between the end markers, we introduce nitrogen into the chamber. There's an immediate increase in CO2 after introducing the nitrogen. This, as far as I can tell, is caused by metabolic acidosis, which shifts the bicarbonate CO2 equilibrium in the direction of CO2, giving off a big non-physiological peak of CO2. Then CO2 output rapidly falls to zero. Then back we go when, as the mitochondria rev up the moment that oxygen is resupplied to them. And then, as you see here, we have the secondary peak and full recovery. That's the CO2 response. Let's look now at the water vapor response. So here, as you can see, after anoxia has been established, the spiracle's open. Well, how do we know the spiracle's open? We know because the water loss rate increases, because that is a side effect of spiracular opening. Then the curious and amazing thing is that the spiracles close again, even though there is no oxygen available for the mitochondria to power this reaction by producing ATP. And then at the end here, we have another peak of water loss where the spiracles open again after oxygen has been resupplied. So if we take all of these things together, and I just want to point out the analyzers are lag corrected, if we take all these things together, here you can see water vapor going up and going back down again to pre-anoxia levels, and then here we have CO2 and water vapor again. Two really remarkable and unexpected things emerged, one of which was we have over here the water loss rate increasing after exposure to anoxia, which is exactly what we expect. But it closes, the spiracles close again, and that means that they're able to power the spiracle closer muscles using anaerobic processes exclusively. Mitochondria are not able to produce anything during this time. And the other curious thing that we found is this hump over here of CO2 output after reestablishment of normoxia. This hump appears to be related, as far as we can tell, to repair processes. In other words, the reintroduction of oxygen causes certain issues, and this metabolic hump over here appears to be connected with the repair of that damage, and I'll come back to that later. But for the moment, you might want to think, well, what will happen if we take this possibility of repairing the damage away from the fly? Okay, so major findings so far. Anaerobic closure of spiracles, very interesting. There was a biphasic recovery phase, as you saw. But the interesting thing is here we give a nice long anoxic exposure to a fly. Here we have the water vapor output going back, but as you notice, it doesn't reestablish its original baseline. The neuromuscular system of the fly has been damaged. And we notice over here no recovery hump. There is no biphasic CO2 signal. In other words, the recovery processes from oxygen reperfusion damage have not been able to occur. So, in that case, the fly is dead. Okay, so just very quickly over here, if we look at the volume of this recovery hump, this is microliters of CO2 obtained by integrating under that recovery hump. Number of flies, they all survive happily until this point when the recovery hump has begun to go down to a low level, so the survival goes down to basically 1 and then 0. So that recovery hump of secondary CO2 output and metabolic processes appears to be essential for recovery. And the longer the anoxia duration, the smaller the degree of spiracular control. Here's an example of a 120-minute fly that basically passed away completely. Here you can see it did not manage to recover spiracular function. It's left its spiracles partly open. Here you can see one spiracle opening again, and another spiracle, and another spiracle, and finally the fly died. Very sad. Okay. What about the difference between anoxia and reperfusion? The interesting thing is that anoxia used to be regarded as the killing agent, for example, in heart ischemia, brain ischemia, aka stroke, etc. Anoxia is really not a problem, even for mammalian tissues. The real issue is reperfusion of oxygen. That causes the damage in us and in many other mammals as well, in many other vertebrates. The mechanism is thought to involve mitochondrial-induced apoptosis, cell death. I'm not going to go into the details on that. I do want to point out that anoxia and reperfusion injury are major clinical problems for humans. And we do not have an invertebrate model as yet for anoxia and reperfusion injury, in spite of the huge significance they have for human health. And the key to producing such a model, as it turns out, is to use the spiracular control assay that I was describing to you, where we're looking at the water vapor output of the fly in real time. So let's look over here at what happens when we give the fly a brief gulp of air for 1 minute during a 60-minute exposure to anoxia. 1 minute is not going to give it a long enough time to go through the recovery hump, which is delayed by several minutes after the reinitiation of normoxia. So the repair processes can't take place yet. 1 minute. As you can see, the CO2 record is exactly what we expect. The mitochondria rev right up and then fall back down again as soon as anoxia is reestablished. But look at water loss rate. Here we have the water loss rate going back up again and staying up. The fly is unable to restore full neuromuscular control as it did here at the beginning, but it is able to after quite a prolonged repair process. Now, what about this? Here's another water vapor output, except here we had 5 successive exposures to anoxia. Here we have the fly burbling along very nicely. It's got its spiracles nicely closed. Nothing is bothering it too much. One exposure to anoxia, it goes up. The neuromuscular control system has been damaged somewhat. Another exposure up again, and another exposure, and basically the fly is toast by that point. So, altogether, this is a graph taken from a paper that Pablo Schirman and I published in PLOS One on this just under a year ago. Here we have successive exposures to CO2. As you can see, the mitochondria are successively less able to utilize the oxygen as time goes on, and the neuromuscular control is basically almost completely wiped out by the third reperfusion event. And we've managed to do this by taking away from the flies the opportunity to repair the oxidative damage during that recovery hump. So here is a graph, here is the reperfusion number. And as you can see, successive reperfusions rapidly caused loss of neuromuscular control and loss of the ability of the mitochondria to oxidize substrate. Now, what about temperature effects? This is a somewhat different topic, but it's an interesting one, I think. And that is, the slope of the exposure time to anoxia versus the recovery time to anoxia, you can call the anoxic recovery coefficient. Okay, so you divide one by the other, it's dimensionless. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Let's say that we have this same graph, which was done at 25 degrees C, except we repeat this experiment at 20 and 30 degrees C. Now, from 20 to 30 degrees C, that is, there's a more than twofold increase in metabolic rate. Now, how about predicting the effect on the slope of the recovery coefficient? So as we take the temperature from 20 to 30, would the slope go up or would the slope go down? Those who think the slope would go up, raise their hands. Those who think the slope would go down, raise their hands. Those who think the slope would remain the same? Okay, let's ask the fly. Here are the three different temperatures. The slope remains the same and the intercepts are almost exactly the same as well. Why is this? Well, there's actually a very simple key. The time required for recovery is really, if I model this, as accumulation and clearance rate, the relation between accumulation of metabolic end products and the clearance rate of metabolic end products. If we call A the amount of metabolic end products accumulated during, say, in this case, in this experiment, 25 minutes of anaerobic metabolism, CR is the clearance rate, okay? Both are proportional to metabolic rate, and both of them are proportional to temperature. I can illustrate this in a very bad diagram. Here is accumulation at low metabolic rate. Here is clearance rate at low metabolic rate. Let's move to high metabolic rate. There is accumulation at high metabolic rate and clearance rate at high metabolic rate. Now, here we have the divided quotient of the two is the amount of time it takes to recover from anoxic exposure at low metabolic rate. Here is the same thing for high metabolic rate. In short, the ratio remains the same because they're evenly matched. Now, this raises an interesting idea for an experiment, and that is we take the flies and expose them to anoxia at a high temperature, thus generating lots of metabolic end product, and then just at the moment when they are taken back down to normal atmospheric conditions, we decrease the temperature, thus making their clearance rate very small, giving you this experiment. High temperature anoxia versus low temperature recovery. So these are experiments I'm actually engaged in at the moment. We're doing a separate paper on this particular subject. Conclusions of this general study. Previous time kinetics were wrong, and in addition, there was no real-time metabolic and neuromuscular data. We fixed that now. We now have the data. We know that anoxic tolerance declines with time, i.e. duration of the exposure to anoxia, and that has a lot, that we can see that happening in that biphasic recovery. As the survival goes down, the biphasic recovery disappears, and basically that recovery hump disappears. A single reperfusion event during anoxia does cause damage, but it appears to be repairable. Multiple events are not repairable. They're rapidly fatal. Thus, we have the first insect model for reperfusion injury with Drosophila. And it's a model with a completely characterized genome. So I'm really hoping it's going to provide a new model animal for use in reperfusion research. And if any of you want to do that, I have no proprietary interest in the idea. Go ahead, please. I just want to acknowledge a couple of people in institutions. Pablo Schirman, my collaborator, helped a great deal. Sable Systems has this basic research initiative, which funded this research. I use the Sable facilities a lot. I want to thank very much Alan Gibbs from UNLV for supplying me with flies. And very many thanks to Robin Turner, whose management and other expertise made this whole thing possible. So I'd be happy to take questions if there's time. Yes. there's nothing that I can think of in the adult life history of Drosophila that would cause them to be selected for anoxia survival. But in the larval stage, when they're crawling around in rotting fruit and what have you, where there can be a lot of microbial and fungal activity which will drive down oxygen levels, I would imagine that there'll be some selective pressure to withstand anoxic conditions, at least for a short time. Why this continues into the adult is just not known. I would assume it to be a neutral effect and one that has just not been selected against. Yes. Yeah, potential protectants, I would imagine there are many of them. And this is one thing I would love to see someone take and run with this kind of research, because these assays are very easy to do. To give the Drosophila mitochondrial protectants of various kinds and determine which ones, and also, I mean, never mind protectants, there are also gene knockout studies and what have you, and gene supplementation studies that could be done to try and determine the exact mechanisms of the apoptosis, anoxia-induced and reperfusion-induced apoptosis, and mitigate those effects. And knowing the way that Drosophila and humans are so similar in spite of everything that Sarah Palin says, you know, this may actually land up being of some clinical use. Yes, Dan.
So you found multiple short-term reperfusion events induced greater damage.
Right. The question is, what about spacing out the multiple reperfusions such that you give them time to recover from each of the reperfusions?
Are they better at it?
That is a great question, and I have no idea. I would suspect probably they will be inducing certain things which will assist them in recovering more rapidly and more completely from future events. I have no I have no factual basis for that making that statement as yet. I would encourage anyone who wants to do that to go ahead and do it.